Stone. Wanna see my picture on the cover? Stone. Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother? Yeah. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone?
This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is the Rolling Stone magazine, the May 2025 edition. We continue with the random notes. The Long Road, Jensen McRae's Path to Healing. The singer-songwriter pours heartbreak and grief into her new LP, I Don't Know How, But They Found Me. Jensen McRae learned quickly that her 20s weren't going to be easy. I don't know if I ever fully healed from anything that's happened, the 27-year-old artist says. She was in a relationship that crumbled after a traumatic incident, and then she ran into a new one that ended too. Both relationships intertwine with her grieving process on I Don't Know How, But They Found Me, her second album, and the follow-up to 2022's Are You Happy Now? The LP, out in late April, is her first on her dream label, Dead Oceans. I wanted to reflect the way healing isn't linear, she explains. The beginning is the beginning and the end is the end, but the middle is very muddy. Below, she shares 5 standout songs from the project. The Rearranger. I thought it would be interesting to write about how, when you are early in love with someone, all you want is to kind of wreck their plans. All you want is to change the trajectory for their life. Before they met you, they didn't have you in their plans. It feels like a very lighthearted way to open the album. It is the shy, tentative inquiry to this other person. Can I wreck your plans? Am I allowed to wreck your plans? And ultimately, over the course of the album, you realize, no, you're not. Savannah. I want anyone who's ever felt like they had to run away from a relationship, anyone who's ever felt trapped in a relationship, to feel like they can hear Savannah and hear themselves in it. I want anyone who's ever felt scared to be like, maybe Jensen has gone through the same thing as me. Maybe this story is about me, and I can cause it to explain my own pain. Daffodils. It's a song about abuse. When I wrote it, it was after midnight, and I think on the first voice memo that I have of it, in the background, you can hear the affirmations that I play when I go to sleep. There's a lot on there that makes my blood run cold. It had to go after Savannah, because Savannah is dipping your toe into the water of that story, and Daffodils is the rest of the story. Let me be wrong. When I was younger, I struggled with having this overinflated sense of self and thinking, I'm a perfect angel, and then oscillating to, I'm terrible and everyone hates me and nothing I do matters. Writing, Let Me Be Wrong, is me finally divorcing myself from that false binary and realizing it's fine to make mistakes. It doesn't make me irredeemable, and being good doesn't make me holier than thou. It just makes me a person who tries really hard. I don't do drugs. It mirrors how repetitive and circular thoughts can be when you're trying to get over someone. I'm a huge Bon Iver fan. I wanted to have that sort of vocoder-ear distorted sound. And when I was writing The Bridge, I was thinking about Adele's cover of Make You Feel My Love by Bob Dylan. I wanted to make something people can relate to, that feeling like you make all the progress, but then you end up going backwards. Also on Random Notes, Shock Value, Timbaland on AI. God presented this tool to me. Labels and artists have lined up against AI music, but the legendary producer is convinced it's the future. Not long ago, Timbaland thought he was tapped out. Since the mid-90s, he repeatedly invented R&B, hip-hop, and pop, lacing classics by the likes of Ayala, Justin Timberlake, and Jay-Z, with skittering beats, future shock synths, and his outrageous ear for samples and hooks. At age 53, though, the producer worried he was aging out of innovation. I thought it was over, Timbaland says, sitting in the sun-splashed studio of his Miami mansion. I can make the drums, but something about it didn't hit the same way in this generation. But then Timbaland met Baby Timbo. That's his pet name for Suno, the powerful, controversial AI music generator currently facing a lawsuit from all the record industry's major labels over its admitted use of countless copyrighted songs in its training data. He is downright evangelical about its capabilities and recently signed on as a creative consultant for the startup. "You can put out great songs in minutes," he says. "God presented this tool to me. I probably made 1,000 beats in 3 months, and a lot of them, not all, are bangers. And from every genre you can possibly think of, I just did 4 K-pop songs this morning." Those 1,000 beats and songs are just the ones Timbaland considers keepers. He selected them from more than 50,000 song generations on the app. "It's still my taste," he says. "I don't have to go play it. I can just know what I want to hear." When Suno launched at the end of 2023, it was purely a text-to-music app. You typed a description, wrote some lyrics, or had the app create them for you, and a song popped out. While that approach remains, it's since evolved to include more sophisticated options, and Timbaland uses one of them exclusively, a beta feature called Covers, which allows you to upload beats or songs of your own creation, and then use Suno to generate infinite variations on them in every imaginable genre. Timbo gives Baby Timbo tracks from his vast archive of unreleased beats and song ideas or newer creations, and turns it loose to reinvent them. Timbaland is one of the only big names in music to acknowledge using, letting alone to advocate, generative AI tools. He's flying in the face of not only a massive lawsuit, but also major backlash from the artistic community. In April 2024, more than 200 musicians, including Billie Eilish, Nicki Minaj, and Stevie Wonder, signed an open letter denouncing AI music. Some of the biggest and most powerful companies are using AI to replace human artists, they wrote. Timbaland is utterly unfazed by his peers' opprobrium, and has no issue with Suno using millions of copyrighted songs to train its AI. "You're talking about copyrights and this or that," he says. "No, man, it's theory. It's learning what is played on earth, and that's all it is. Knowledge of musicality." He says musicians should work with AI companies to figure out, like, how do we eat off of this? And that can be worked out. Timbaland's current creative partner, Zayed Portillo, a young brainy tech enthusiast, steps over to the iMac on a desk in the corner and demonstrates their workflow. He plays a song idea Timbaland laid down in 2010. They uploaded it into Suno, and using the Covers function, generated variations using prompts with simple genre descriptions. Timbaland insists that I don't publish his full actual wording. They may not be copyrighted, but the prompts are now property. He's trying to protect. They're the sauce. In the variations, AI transforms his hummed counter melody into guitar lines or lovely female voices, fleshing out the song in multiple genres, all with machine-generated vocalists. Portillo and an outside songwriter worked out some lyrics to one of these iterations, an R&B banger with buzzy bass. Then they ran the Covers function again on that version, plugging the new lyrics into the interface, and they got what they considered to be a finished song with a sultry female vocalist who happens to not exist. They're not opposed to the idea of simply releasing the AI version, but they also might send such a song to an artist and have them do their own take on the vocals. Timbaland says he's already trying to get big-name artists to record some of these creations. So far, the undeniability capabilities of AI music generators have been reflected on the way charts only via a counter-reaction. Beyonce said she embraced the organic sound of her Album of the Year-winning Cowboy Carter as a direct response to the technology. With artificial intelligence and digital filters and programming I wanted to go back to real instruments, and I used very old ones. Lady Gaga said to Bruno Mars, Die With a Smile was recorded live in a studio with an actual band. It's no coincidence that alongside all this live instrumentation is the rise of AI. That song's producer, Andrew Wyatt, recently told me. People are like, okay, computers are getting so good that they can do this other stuff. What's the realest, rawest thing that it can't do? But Timbaland has little patience for that sentiment. If you listen and you feel good, how's it losing its humanity, he asks. Why are you beating yourself up on something that's in your body that you feel? Next is the featured article, Lil Wayne Lives by His Own Rules. Chasing a hip-hop legend across the country as he wraps up the Carter Six and says and does whatever the hell he wants. It's 5 a.m. in Georgia, and Free Sound Studios is quiet. I'm in a side room of the vast Oki complex near Atlanta, preparing to be the first person outside of Lil Wayne's circle to hear the Carter Six, the album he's been working on for 6 years. On this mid-January night, our listening session was supposed to begin at 1 a.m, but it took 2 hours for Wayne to show up. Wayne's manager, Fabian Mascarello, an affable, stout Queens native wearing all black, told me that the hip-hop icon is doing some last-minute edits to songs before I hear them. It's been a long minute. I oogled the Labyrinth recording console in the room. I wouldn't know the first knob to push, but I have mastered the Keurig machine. I need caffeine. Most of my time in Lil Wayne's orbit, chasing him across the map, has been an exercise in indeterminate waiting. I've already taken 2 trips to Los Angeles for interviews that didn't happen. The latter missed connections due to calamitous wildfires. Last night, Wayne headlined a concert at Atlanta's State Farm Arena. I got an onstage glimpse of his set, but we didn't talk. Our cross-country game of cat and mouse will continue after tonight, resulting in missed interviews, late nights that turn into early mornings, and a postponed Rolling Stone cover. But back at Tree Sound, I finally get the nod that Wayne is ready for me. Mascarello escorts me into Wayne's room, and I'm smacked with a weed stench as I cross into his musky territory. He stands near the door in baggy, all-black Balenciaga gear with a black band around his neck, not unlike the Sawyer rag he and the Hot Boys popularized nearly 30 years ago. A gleaming platinum Cuban chain sits atop his shirt. In the back of the room are Wayne's 15-year-old son, Cameron, in a pink Bappy hoodie, and his personal photographer, Philip Lopez. Across the room is a tatted-up Lil Twist, who's been signed to Wayne's Young Money Entertainment since he was 17 years old. He looks nothing like the baby-faced Mohawk rapper first seen when the label began assaulting the Billboard charts in the late aughts. Wayne daps me, then mumbles something like, "You're here to listen to the shit?" while picking a track for his engineer to play. Admittedly, I'm too busy processing the gravity of the moment to remember the specifics of the first song that I hear. I do recall an up-tempo beat over which Wayne spits furiously at his free associative best. He nods his head feverishly to the track. After it's over, he approaches and looks me in the eye. "If you got a favorite rapper, tell him, suck my dick," he says. Mascarello laughs uproariously. I'm fully awake. At 42 years old and 30 years into his career, Lil Wayne is still driven by the fever to be the best rapper alive. Born Dwayne Michael Carter Jr. in the Holly Grove section of New Orleans, he was signed around age 11 after calling the Cash Money Records office every day, rapping into their voicemail until founders Brian Birdman Williams and his brother Ronald Slim Williams gave him a chance. Decades later, after helping Cash Money become a Southern rap giant as 1/4 of the Hot Boys, then becoming the label's flagship solo artist, then helming the Young Money movement, Wayne still makes music every day. When I ask about the last time Wayne went on vacation, he says matter-of-factly, that vacations are recording. Okay, sure, but how about an actual chill vacation? I never understood that, he says, burning blunt in hand. What are we taking a break from? If it's a vacation, you're supposed to do things that you enjoy, right? So I take my music with me. And in turn, music has taken Wayne to heights few rappers can compare. His 13 solo albums, 5 EPs, 30 or so mixtapes, and hundreds of features have earned him 187 appearances on the Billboard Hot 100. In 2024, his feature on Tyler, the Creator's Sticky, extended his streak of consecutive years with a Hot 100 appearance to 21, a record for any active artist. Through health scares, legal troubles that held up 2018's That's Carter 5 for 5 years, and 8 months on Rikers Island for a gun possession charge, Rain is still here, creating with the hunger of a rap rookie. Wyclef Jean, a key collaborator on Carter 6, thinks Wayne will be seen as an icon centuries from now. You got to think like how people study Bach and Thelonious Monk, Miles Davis, and Shakespeare, he explains over Zoom from Paris. He's going to be regarded as one of the great Renaissance wordsmith composers of our generation. Wayne's disregard for norms helped him reshape the contours of hip-hop. His locks, body-enveloping tats, and colorful clothing make him a fashion maverick, serving as the mood board for hordes of young MCs to follow. He held it down for lyricists during the onslaught of ringtone rap and snap dancing, and did so with a relentless output that redefined what prolific meant in hip-hop. Moody, crooning deep cuts like Me and My Drank and Prostitute, engendered entire wings of nihilistic, melodic hip-hop that followed them. He's tried his hand at practically every style and theme, even dropping Rebirth, his 2010 rock album. Wayne's history is still being written. Recently, he fed fans via collaborations with everyone from Doja Cat to Lil Baby to Nas to Jack Harlow. In 2023, he dropped the album Welcome to Color Grove with friend 2 Chainz, and the mixtape The Fix Before the 6, an appetizer for Carter 6. It feels like these days Wayne is more focused on bar work and experimentation than chart chasing. Beyond his artistry, Wayne's no-ego approach as an executive paved the way for Young Money signees Drake and Nicki Minaj to become icons and set up artists like Tyga for sustained success. His latest entrepreneurial endeavor is co-running his Young Money APAA sports agency, representing more than 100 athletes, including the Heisman Trophy-winning Travis Hunter, set to be a top pick in the 2025 NFL Draft. Like Jay-Z and 50 Cent, Wayne is a rapper entrepreneur, but he doesn't always get credit for wearing multiple hats. He says he doesn't mind, mostly because he's still focused on the rapper part and uses a basketball metaphor to explain. Imagine you're a player coach still averaging 30 a night and a nigga asking you, hey, do you feel slighted that they don't put you in the coach type of conversations? He says, no, I'm still dropping 30 points a night. I'm fine being the best rapper. And then you just found out, oh shit, he owns Young Money. Oh, he put Drake out. Oh my God. The first curveball in my reporting occurs somewhere over the Rockies on a flight from New York to Los Angeles to interview Wayne back in December. I'm told that Wayne has an emergency and needs to cancel. I'm sure that his health is fine, he just can't do the interview. I fly back to New York the next day. Then in early January, I return to L.A. just in time to witness the catastrophic wildfires spreading across the city. I head over to meet Wayne at a studio in Thousand Oaks, California. Several members of his team are there, including Marscolo, who's wearing a gleaming Young Money chain he got from the star as a Christmas gift. Mascarello planned to return the favor with giant toe slippers. I hear a loud, urgent buzz from Mascarello's phone and think it's another wildfire advisory. In fact, it's his ringtone for a Wayne phone call. Mascarello answers in speaker mode while walking out of the room. Before he leaves, I overhear Lil Wayne exclaim, "I'm not doing that shit tonight. You see what's going on?" Wayne, I learn later, had to evacuate his Hidden Hills home, which was undamaged except for temporary power loss. Mascarello returns to the room about 10 minutes later and informs me tonight isn't happening. The next day, the Sunset Fire forces me out of my Hollywood hotel and back to New York. Last month, I got the cancellation alert in the air. At least this time, I hear Wayne's voice. 11 days later, at Atlanta's State Farm Arena, the crowd is ready for the main event, a Lil Wayne concert just before the college football playoff championship game. There's just one problem. Lil Wayne isn't here yet. It's 11 in the evening, an hour after Wayne's set was supposed to start, and a dozen or so people, mostly members of Wayne's team, wait backstage. Mascarello paces while taking phone calls. One balding arena worker quips to his coworkers in a Georgia twang, "You think I could grow some hair by the time this fucker gets here?" 30 minutes later, things abruptly go from 0 to 60. Three Atlanta cops dash outside to meet Wayne's Sprinter van. Soon after, Wayne's sons Cameron, 16-year-old Dwayne III, a.k.a. rapper Lil Toon, and 15-year-old Neil, a.k.a. rapper Lil Novi, file in. And then the man of the hour bounces in, adorned in a baggy black and white camouflage sweatsuit, black boots, a black beanie, and white sunglasses. I bet it's all Balenciaga. His platinum pinky ring and lit blunt are competing to be the most absurdly large things on his fingers. There are two free Lil Durk t-shirts in the dressing room. Later, when I ask Wayne about them, he tells me he didn't know the Chicago rapper was in jail. Atlanta Hawks greats Trae Young and Dominique Wilkins are probably the only other people who could get away with walking through the arena's metal detector toking a blunt. Neither would. The detector goes off as Wayne passes through, but no one gives a fuck. There's relief and excitement as the previously scattered parts of Wayne's ecosystem huddle together and form a wall around him, security in front. About 10 of us briskly walk on stage as the lights dim. Just 5 minutes after he exited the Sprinter, the crowd pops to the opening flares of Mr. Carter. I was wondering the same thing as the song's hook, which asks, "Mr. Carter, where have you been?" I've come to realize that time simply isn't a factor in Wayne's world. Philip Lopez, the photographer, tells me that their private jet to Atlanta was scheduled to leave L.A. at 1 in the morning. They sat on board waiting until Wayne showed up at 6. No one I speak to recalls Wayne's unpunctuality or late hours resentfully. They simply chalk it up as a feature, not a defect, of being around a nonconformist. Wycliffe theorizes that he and Wayne are night owls because of their shared astrological sign. Most Libras are nocturnal, man. In the 90s, Birdman would take the hot boys to the studio to record overnight, and the routine stuck. Wayne's average day ends shortly after leaving the studio and getting breakfast while watching morning sports shows like First Take. He sleeps, then wakes up to dinner around 6 in the evening. Later, I tell him that his schedule is the inverse of the average human's. "I never thought of that like that. Thank you," he says, laughing. Wayne apparently got enough sleep to rock State Farm Arena with a career-spanning set. He plays a piece of Back That Ass Up and Money on My Mind, as well as standards such as Drop the World and Uproar. He brings out 2 Chainz for 207's Duffel Bags Boy and 2013's Rich as Fuck before continuing on his own. At one point, a snippet of Harry Belafonte's Deo, the Banana Boat song, morphs into 6'7". Most of the crowd seems mid to late 20s and up, but is diverse in terms of ethnicity, fashion sense, and overall vibe. Leaving the stage to Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You, Wayne greets 2 Chainz and his aunt in the loading dock. They confer about plans for later that evening. I'm going to call you, 2 Chainz says, as their 2 camps separate. Wayne naturally ends up in the studio after the show. When I try to enter a backstage room where Wayne is taking pictures with fans, his security blocks me with his elbow. I tell him I'm with Rolling Stone. He dismissively scoffs, nah, as if I had asked him for $20 instead of seeking to do my job. After the brief photo session, everyone exits the arena and jumps into a police-led cavalcade of sprinters and SUVs. The next night, at Tree Sound Studios, Wayne mostly lets the album speak for itself, hovering near his engineer and pointing out which songs to play next. Sometimes he offers a tidbit about guest appearances by Elephant Man and MGK, or producers like Ye, who produced one track that may not make the album, and Wheezy. Then he walks to the far corner of the room and jams out in his own world. He two-steps to some songs and feverishly nods his head to others. I hear a track where Wayne deftly mimics the cadence of Biggie's One More Chance, and Tupac's Hit 'Em Up. As for press time, only one song I hear has an official title. Another track is an ode to Cruising Through L.A., featuring a shout-out to the late Matthew Perry. Wayne laughingly tells me afterwards that he didn't know Perry and only added him after researching a name that would fit the syllable space. The album June 6th is the 6th in his Canonical Carter series, and it's a testament to his malleable mic presence. Wayne rhymes over different tempos and moods, but always sounds like himself. Another song I hear, which I later learn likely won't make the album, juxtaposes an idyllic riff with a gruff hook asserting, "Go hard on a bitch." Wayne says that line is cribbed from a Birdman bar on an old Cash Money track. Wayne divulges that he's still cool with Birdman, the surrogate father who shepherded his career until a 2014 contract dispute led Wayne to sue Birdman's Cash Money Records for $51 million. He accused the label of withholding money owed to him and delaying the release of The Carter Five, which he had already turned into the label. In 2018, Wayne settled for a sum of reportedly more than $10 million. Since then, however, the pair have patched things up. Still pops. Talk to him every day, Wayne states, noting that Birdman often calls him for sports betting advice. He thinks time mended the relationship. Also, a nigga being happy for my success, he says. He gave me the ball years ago and told me, go ahead, now show me the end zone. Turning to Rolling Stone's Comedy Class of 2025, the moment's brightest stars are changing the game on stage and on screen. Taking comedy to the streets, the funny, viral, and coming for late night. How digital talk show hosts are reinventing classic formats for a very online age. Carson, Letterman, O'Brien, Byra, Rama, Williams. You may not recognize those last few names, but there's a direct line between them and some late night legends. They're part of the wave of TikTok talk shows hosts who are remixing old school late night tropes, breezy interview segments, parlor games, silly characters for a digital audience. Gone are hosts sitting behind the bulky desks. The stars of the future are mics on the mo. My job is to share the mess, says Tiff Byra, host of the dating show Street Hearts, in which she coaches 2 complete strangers through an impromptu first date on a New York City sidewalk, donning one of her signature sparkly, furry, and/or pink hats. Byra uses her charm to smooth over awkward moments and move the conversation along. We've all cried about our ex in the back of an Uber. It's okay, she says. No matter who you are, even if you are a big celebrity, there's one thing that we can all talk about, and that's love. Byra's show feels like a hybrid of 2 slightly earlier internet-era hits that emerged from the late-night meets cringe comedy bloodline. Billy Eichner's shouty 2010s masterpiece, Billy on the Street, and British comedian Amelia Dimmelberg's Chicken Soup Date. Both shows grew from focusing on mere mortals to featuring regular appearances by celebrities. Dimmenberg's flitty chats with Andrew Garfield have been dissected so much she's now done interviews about their interviews. Similarly, Street Hearts has become a stop on the media circuit for some stars. Lil Nas X and Florence Pugh, among others, have appeared next to Byra's microphone. Much like their broadcast predecessors, as these creators draw more eyeballs with big-name guests, they also refine their hosting personas, becoming a cheery, reliable presence on people's phones. There is this parasocial relationship. You feel like you're with people you know, says Anne Libra, an associate professor of comedy at Columbia College in Chicago. I'm going to show this guest as a fun person, and you're going to see them through me as someone you trust. Shorter attention spans are driving even shorter content that can take comics and one easily repeatable stick to a new life. There's a music trivia TikTok track star, which host and creator Jack Cohn operates like a snappy discography quiz show. Caleb Simpson's apartment tours are a Gen Z version of MTV's Cribs. And the genre has become so popular that the entire production companies have sprung up with the sole purpose of turning creators with big followings into the next IT talk show host. Anaya Williams was already a popular creator when she was approached by Mutuals Media. The company wanted a host for a street show that combined comedy with queer history education. Williams, meanwhile, wanted to let people know that she was more than a drag queen with an iPhone. Inner gaydar, which she describes as gay roulette of a stranger freaking out because they don't know more about historic queer figures or community icons. To be a good host, you have to roll with the punches, she says. With my intersection as a drag queen, a trans person, a black person in America, I'm able to keep things moving forward and the heart of someone's trying to say. Kareem Rama, one of the most famous digital talk show hosts, wears sunglasses and a tie when he clocks in as the host of Subway Takes, an ambitious short-form show where everyone from average New Yorkers to celebrities, influencers, and even vice presidential candidates drop by to plug a project and spew a nonsensical take next to him. For example, air travel should be treated like surgery, or we should throw all chiropractors in prison. With more than 1.6 million followers across platforms, Rama is direct about why modern comedians are taking late-night style and making it work in their own way. It's a better gig. If I was offered Jimmy Fallon's spot, I would say why, he says. You have to show up 5 nights a week for the rest of your life and interview people you don't want to interview. Why would you want to do that? Turning now to one of the featured stories, Battle for Greenland. We're Greenlanders, and this is our land. President Trump's threats of a takeover have put Greenland on the geopolitical map. At a pivotal moment, we traveled to the resource-rich Arctic island to make sense of the hype. Waving red and white flags and blasting an independent song from a speaker box, a parade of about 40 Simuit faithful, long the dominant political party, is on the march in Nuuk, Greenland's frozen capital. Cloaked in parkas, they pass a cluster of wooden homes built by the first Danish settlers 3 centuries ago and giant chunks of glacial ice stranded on the beach before stopping in the old harbor. This is what passes for a big crowd in a vast country of nearly 57,000 people, and their full-throated fever cuts through the bracing February cold. The week before, Prime Minister Mute Edge called for snap elections after President Donald Trump's repeated threats to acquire the strategically located and resource-rich Arctic island. We are in a serious time, Edge wrote on Facebook, a time we have never experienced in our country. The time is not for internal division, but for cooperation and unity for our country. 5 of Greenland's 6 main political parties favor independence from Denmark, the former colonizer that still controls its foreign affairs and defense, and pays for more than half the government's public budget. but they differ on how quickly that should happen and whether U.S. interest is ultimately more of an opportunity or a menace to Greenland's long-term political and economic freedom. Siumet, a partner in the two-party government coalition, had days earlier announced its intention to hold a vote on independence. The first step will be free association, and after many years, full independence, says Doris Jensen, a member of parliament leading the parade. Minutes after the Siumut crowd moves on, the other half of the ruling left-wing coalition, Inuit Ataqilt, descends on the waterfront in a flurry of flags and slogans, their boots crunching the ice. Its party leaders had just broken ranks with Siumut, countering they would not rush an independence referendum after the vote. A more gradual approach, they reasoned, will ensure that welfare programs funded by Denmark are not disrupted and the so-called right alliances maintained. We have always known that whatever we do in Greenland for full autonomy from the Danish realm, that the United States would try and grab us, says Akolek Linge, a veteran Inuit rights activist and party founder who once stood outside the Danish parliament demanding independence. Compared with other indigenous people in the Arctic, we are the most independent country. We have rights to our own land and are accepted as a people according to international law. Linge, age 77, now worries that the autonomy he fought for and the island's considerable resource wealth could be lost by hastily breaking away from Denmark. The situation right now with the U.S. is so threatening that people are having second thoughts about independence. My generation is very worried. People don't trust the U.S. like we did a few months ago. Anything is possible. A flash of the young activist comes in a parting message to President Trump. Come freeze your effing ass off here. Come in the winter. Then we will put you in the middle of the ice cap, and you will see what Greenland is all about. As the rally ends, Linz introduces me to Edge, the 37-year-old Prime Minister of Greenland. He rejects Trump's overtures to buy or annex Greenland, but he's also been strident in his calls for full independence from Denmark to remove the shackles of colonialism, saying, "It is now time to take the next step for our country," in a New Year's speech that hinted at a referendum. Of late, though, he's evaded foreign reporters pressing him about Trump. We shake hands, and on hearing I'm an American journalist, he spins on a dime and breaks into a fast walk up the street. Having spent most of its existence on the margins of the geopolitical map, Greenland now finds itself smack in its center. Warming temperatures are opening new shipping lanes and making oil, gas, and mineral reserves more accessible, turning the world's largest island into a strategic prize in the brewing competition between the U.S., China, and Russia for supremacy in the Arctic. President Trump wanted to buy Greenland during his first term, and in 2020, the U.S. reopened its consulate in Nuuk after nearly 70 years. Upon winning re-election, Trump declared Greenland to be an absolute necessity for America's national security while refusing to rule out using military conquest. One way or the other, he told lawmakers in March, we're going to get it. The imperial bluster has sent shockwaves through Denmark, an ostensible NATO ally. In a heated January 15th phone call with Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen, Trump doubled down on threats to target Denmark with trade tariffs if it doesn't cede or sell, igniting a full-blown panic. The U.S. is Denmark's top export market outside of the European Union, receiving more than $12 billion worth of Danish products in 2023. But in Greenland, the background tension has forced a popular reckoning on the country's future. Now the whole world knows where Greenland is, said Erik Jensen, the outgoing Minister of Mineral Resources and Labor. And it has pushed a lot of issues to the forefront about becoming more independent from Denmark. Like many leaders here, Jensen acknowledges it will take many years to build up the kind of diversified, homegrown economy that will make independence viable. Greenland is heavily dependent on fishing exports, and an annual block grant of more than $500 million from Denmark covers employment, health care, and education. Its population is declining, with a workforce that lacks specialized training. And yet tourism is surging to record levels. Fisheries have the potential to earn far more, and the country's underground resources are mostly untapped, including rare earth elements used in green technologies that are the envy of U.S. officials looking to head off China's global monopoly. Over the course of 2 weeks traveling around the capital and fishing villages on the southwest coast, conversations with politicians, hunters, artists, and entrepreneurs yielded a near-universal refrain: "We aren't for sale, but we are open for business." While Greenlanders overwhelmingly oppose becoming the 51st state, most want independence, and some hope Trump's interest will usher in the jobs and investments needed to become more self-sufficient and turn the page on a colonial legacy marked by inequalities. Still, that optimism is tempered by fears that Greenland's decades-long independence drive could be hijacked by a ham-fisted and unpredictable U.S. administration that is running roughshod over its closest allies. U.S. security is our security. We're allies, and we'd like to do more business with them, Jensen says. But that doesn't mean that we'd like to become a part of the United States. On a hill overlooking the sprawling Bay of Nuuk, a 7-foot-tall statue of a man clutching a shepherd's staff and Bible faces the headwinds. Hans Edge, a Danish-Norwegian Protestant missionary, arrived in 1721 with a royal mandate to convert Norse settlers who had occupied the island for several hundred years. They were long gone, so he set about converting the native Inuit population instead. Brisk trade in whale blubber and seal skins eventually made Greenland the most prized possession in the Danish realm. In 1979, Greenland was granted home rule. This was expanded into self-rule 30 years later, allowing the country greater control over its domestic affairs. These days, Greenlanders enjoy a welfare system with universal health care and free education, paid for in part by Denmark. Danes view themselves as good colonizers, at least compared with the brutalities exacted by powers like the United States, Spain, and Belgium against native communities. The self-portrait of the Danes is that all or most of what the Danish state did as a colonial power was with the best intentions, says Birger Popel, a Danish economist at the University of Greenland who has lived in the country for 40 years. But in the eyes of many Inuit Greenlanders, the Edge statute is a lightning rod for cultural erasure and other state abuses that have come to light. Danish policies aimed at modernization and assimilation saw forced relocation to larger towns and the suppression of the Inuit language and customs. Families were torn apart, with some children sent to Denmark for schooling. In the 1960s and 1970s, authorities carried out a large-scale voluntary birth control campaign against Inuit girls and women, inserting devices without their knowledge or consent. Prime Minister Edge has gone so far as to call this a genocide carried out by the Danish state against the Greenland population. More recently, grievances have been inflamed by accusations that Danish companies and the state extracted billions of dollars in mineral wealth with little benefit to the local economy, further tainting the caretaker narrative at a vulnerable moment for Denmark. For the past 300 years, the riches we need to build our country have been delivered to Denmark, and I think it's sad, says Timothy Zeb, a 36-year-old former hash smuggler I find butchering a seal on a rocky beach below the Edge statue. Pot-bellied with a chin-strap beard, skull cap, and sleeve tattoos, Zeb just happened to be walking by when a fisherman pulled up with the extra meat and called him over. He posted a message on Facebook and went to work with a pocket knife, turning the slabs red as locals lined up for their share. Even in Greenland's largest city, communal traditions still hold. Zeb carves me a piece of blubber, and I gulp it down. The gelatinous tissue is oily and salt-tinged. We are a peaceful people, and we have everything here. Fish, uranium, rare earths, he tells me. We must make deals with other countries. When I tell Zeb I'm from the U.S., he informs me that Trump shared one of his videos on social media to troll Denmark. In the clip, he wears a MAGA cap and booms, "Buy us, buy Greenland. We don't want to be colonized by the Danish government anymore." Trump took the over-the-top bit and ran with it, proclaiming, "I'm hearing that the people of Greenland are MAGA. Greenland is an incredible place, and people will benefit tremendously if and when it becomes part of our nation. We will protect it and cherish it from a very vicious outside world. Make Greenland great again." Danish media were quick to report that Zeb is a convicted criminal who once escaped from prison. Zeb insists he's cleaned up his act since becoming a father and downplays the viral "please buy us" plea as lighthearted provocation. But he affirms his fondness for Trump and says he hopes that the United States partners with Greenland to tap resource wealth that could feed all the lands and transform his country. "We don't want to be part of Russia or China," he says. "Everyone else is welcome to come make history." President Trump is hardly the first U.S. official to fixate on Greenland. Back in 1868, U.S. Secretary of State William Seward, the man who negotiated the purchase of Alaska from Russia, hailed Greenland as a place of almost bottomless natural resources that could empower the U.S. to command the commerce of the world. He tried to buy it and Iceland for $5.5 million and might have succeeded had the $7.2 million Alaska deal not been ridiculed as a folly. During World War II, Greenland became a de facto American protectorate where bases allowed U.S. forces to thwart Nazi Germany's control of critical air and sea lanes. In 1946, the U.S. offered $100 million in gold for the territory. Denmark declined, but joined NATO and signed a treaty that established U.S. defense areas to boost collective security during the Cold War. Chief among them, the Thule Air Base, a massive installation 950 miles shy of the North Pole that allowed NATO to track Soviet submarines and missile activity over Greenland, the shortest flight path from Europe to North America. In the 1960s, a top-secret U.S. nuclear weapons program, codenamed Project Ice Worm, was partially built under the ice sheet east of Thule, with a plan to embed 600 nuclear missiles, each aimed at major Soviet cities. The program was scrapped. In another notorious 1968 incident, a B-52 bomber carrying four thermonuclear bombs crashed near Thule. At the height of the war, the U.S. had more than 10,000 troops stationed at Thule and 17 military installations across Greenland. In 2023, Thule was renamed the Pifuk Space Base, and it still hosts roughly 150 personnel who maintain a ballistic missile warning system. Today, the Arctic is heating up four times faster than the rest of the world, and a new great game is intensifying in the north. As sea ice melts, Russia is ramping up naval patrols and expanding its fleet of 40 icebreakers. Not to be left out, China has focused more on economic inroads, acquiring mines, ports, and airfields as part of a broader Polar Silk Road campaign in the region. Though Greenland is technically covered by U.S. security guarantees through Denmark's NATO membership, the Danes have admitted their defense capabilities are woefully out of date. Four Thetis-class patrol boats, a surveillance aircraft, and dog sled patrols to monitor a landmass 3.5 times the size of Texas with more than 27,000 miles of coastline. In the wake of President Trump's threats, Denmark has pledged more than $2 billion in military upgrades. Kuno Fechner, a Greenlandic member of parliament fighting for independence, believes that the security concerns underlying Trump's threats are legitimate given Greenland's location and political trajectory. If Greenland becomes independent, he points out, Denmark has previously threatened to pull its annual subsidies and defense assistance, creating a security vacuum. Who will take over? who is a national security interest in regards to the geostrategic position of Greenland, that is the United States. 50 years old, with black flame glasses and an urbane matter-of-fact manner, Fenker believes the media caricature that pro-U.S. Greenlanders are a fringe collection of useful idiots for the Trump administration. He says he studied law to help Greenland break free of Denmark and called Trump's rhetoric the best marketing move in our history for making Denmark and the wider world take its independence goals more seriously. Before we met up for coffee, he had driven his fiancée, one of the two Greenlandic members of Danish parliament, to the airport for a campaign trip, given interviews to a pair of foreign media outlets, and recorded a podcast. Fenker likens Greenland's relationship with Denmark to a forced child marriage that began in 1953 when Greenland was unilaterally absorbed. In principle, Greenland becomes constitutionally equal to Denmark. In practice, he says, this was not the case. Although his Danish grandfather had worked as an inspector for the colonial administration, Fenker says that as an adult, he initially faced discrimination for his mixed background. Working for a shipping company, he struggled to understand why nearly all the cargo went to Denmark. He saw that most companies in Greenland are run by Danes, but it was in remote northern villages conducting impact assessments for oil exploration that his social consciousness really awakened. The extreme discrimination made my sense of protecting Inuit people become very much alive. When Fenker began speaking up on behalf of Inuit rights, he claims his job prospects dried up. So he plunged into politics with a mission to develop Greenland's economy so it can stand on its own. We're a real people with the right to sovereignty, he says, and we need business people to come here and see the possibilities, instead of thinking we are just a piece of ice. He also wants to enact strict reforms that ensure more of the benefits from fishing, mining, and other potentially lucrative industries stays in Greenland. We have to think for ourselves and not just give up our resources all the time. In January, Fenker traveled to Trump's inauguration festivities in Washington to advocate for stronger ties with the U.S. The impromptu trip did not go down well with his party, Simuit. On returning, some accused him of being a Trojan horse for Trump's agenda. He switched to Nalarek, a secessionist party that seeks free association status and a defense agreement with the U.S. People are fear-mongering by misinterpreting Donald Trump and making him the big bad wolf, even though we have a worse wolf in the way Denmark is treating Greenland. President Trump has cherry-picked such affirmations as proof that Greenlanders want to be with us, which couldn't be further from the truth. A January opinion poll taken after his annexation threats showed that while a large majority want independence, 85% of people opposed joining the U.S., with just 6% in favor. And though more than half of the respondents said they'd vote yes to an independent state referendum if it were held tomorrow, scarcely anyone thinks the country is ready. We have to learn from other former colonies around the world that just because they gained independence, it doesn't mean their whole situation just improved like that, says Eka Nivana, a 30-year-old Inuit poet and actor. On a rare sunny afternoon, we take a walk to the Edge statue, where a few tourists mill around snapping pictures. The statue has bothered Nivana ever since she was a teen, and she still drives past it each day on her way to work. If she had her way, the missionary eyesore would be replaced by Arnulfing Gug, the Inuit legendary woman explorer who traversed the Northwest Passage by sled dog. Her views about Denmark, however, have grown more complicated with age. Nivana was 8 when she moved to Copenhagen with her parents in search of better opportunities. She lost her language, but says a cosmopolitan exposure was a gift that awakened her to native struggles around the world, from Standing Rock to the Marshall Islands. On returning home at age 22, she rekindled her Inuit identity. She got a traditional chin tattoo, 2 parallel lines from the chin to the lip, later complemented by healing dots that recede from her eyes. She wrote poetry and performed on stage to raise awareness about the gathering impact of climate change on her homeland. Despite having no film experience, she caught the attention in 2022 of a casting director for True Detective Night Country and got the part of Agent Navarro's sister, a troubled soul who ends her life by stripping naked and walking out onto the ice. Nirvana's debut is haunting, the kind of virtuoso performance that brims with lived pain and grief. Not long after she moved back to Greenland in 2020, vandals splashed the Edge statue with red paint and Inuit symbols. Nirvana was by then a prominent voice in the debate about decolonization and faced charges for the vandalism. She denied being involved and was ultimately acquitted, but the police case staggered on for almost 2 years and drove her to attempt suicide. Newark is a small place, a village really, and the intensity of the internet debate, she says, and the fear that I can't be safe in my own community anymore became too much. The ordeal moved her to become more outspoken about mental health and depression, topics that are becoming less taboo. Greenland has one of the highest suicide rates in the world and is the leading cause of death among young men. Nirvana says the epidemic stems from a tangle of factors spanning isolation, poverty, alcoholism, and domestic abuse, all compounded by the hangover of intergenerational trauma. And yet for all the inequalities and racism that persists, Nirvana recognizes the social benefits of living in the Danish realm. If you compare us to natives living in the United States, I think we are in a better situation, she says, citing the free health care and education provided by the Nordic welfare state. At the same time, she acknowledges the groundswell of anger towards Denmark. And I feel it too. I feel enraged. You hear about the billions of dollars taken out of the land and so much poverty. But at the end of the day, I think most people want independence, she says. This concludes the reading of the story about Greenland and the May 2025 issue of Rolling Stone magazine. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.